Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on struggling for the soul of the labour movement. The occasion is Jim Mackin's most recent book, What Is To Be Done? The Struggle for the Soul of the Labour Movement, published by Federation Press. So Jim's going to lead off. I'll introduce him briefly, followed by Cassandra Wilkinson, followed by Rodney Cavalier. Jim makes a welcome first speech to the Sydney Institute. He's a life member of the ALP. He was on the waterfront as Secretary of the Marine Motor Drivers Union from 1953 to 1957, Foundation Secretary of the Flight Stewards Association and Flight Engineers Association from the late 50s to the mid-60s, and President of the New South Wales branch of the Federated Clerks Union in the early 60s. He was also a barrister. He was made a judge of the New South Wales Industrial Commission from 1975 to 1989, and is the author of several books on the unions and on Labour Party politics. So his most recent book, What Is To Be Done, which is why we're here tonight, and there are copies of the book by Federation Press that Janet Grundy's got up the back. Cassandra Wilkinson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was here some years ago discussing her own book at the time. She's well known to many of you, writes a column for The Australian, and was most recently an advisor to the Keneally Labor Government in New South Wales. She's worked for Labor Ministers in New South Wales, and she's a writer, commentator. And Rodney Cavalier, of course, very well known. He's author of many books. He spoke here on a number of occasions. He also was chair of the sequicentenary of Responsible Government in New South Wales, and some of the books that his committee funded are available up the back. They were published also by Federation Press. So we thought we'd lead off with Jim Mackin, go to Cassandra Wilkinson, go to Rodney Cavalier. Our speakers will speak for no more than 15 minutes each, and then we've got plenty of time for questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock, but maybe a bit earlier. Jim Mackin, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I hesitate to call you comrades because it might be misinterpreted. Look, the reason I wrote that small book, and it's only 80 pages, is because I hold the view that a one-party state is no good for the government, no good for the party. If the Labour Party does not radically change and return to government or potential government, it will be a bad day for Australia. Now, before you can understand what has to be done to restore Labour to a reasonable government or opposition, you have to know why it's in the present mess. Ladies and gentlemen, it's in the present mess because it misunderstood, radically misunderstood, the counterculture of the late 60s. At that time, those of you are much too young probably to remember it, but at that time, the world was tipped on its head. Everything in the society changed. Everything changed, including all of the structures of society. It was a very peculiar time to live. In politics you had the Family Law Act, you had the Whitlam government, not like any Labour government ever before it. It changed foreign policy, changed education policy, it changed social policy, it changed everything. And it was in response to the events of 1968. In 1968, every university in the Western world went into student rebellion overnight. It was so serious that General de Gaulle needed four legions of French troops and the deal with the Communist Party to take control of Paris. Our own universities were the same. Everything changed. Now, it was all hard if you lived at that time to recognise it. The Labour Party did not recognise it. The unions did not recognise it. And neither did the churches. Neither did a lot of other institutions. But the problem was that unless at that time you changed, you were going out backwards historically. Now, without going into the detail of that, I recommend some of the really good books on the rebellions of 1968 if you're interested in secular history. What happened with the Labour Party was that they were faced with the dilemma of a society sliding into chaos, in a sense. So what happened was, you had the Whitlam government, you then had Keating, and you had Hawke, and they tore up the rule book even further. Keating unashamedly said, forget Labour's traditional policies. What we have now is a new god called the market. And underneath the market, therefore, we've all got to go for greater productivity. Never mind traditional unions. Never mind where nationally we sold the Commonwealth Bank. I bet they're regretting it now. They sold Qantas. They turned Labour history on its head. There was no recognisable connection with traditional Labour policies. And everyone said, we've got to do it, it's the times, it's the market. To make sure that the market was supreme, they cut the trade union movement down by saying, in future, we will force every small union to amalgamate with the big unions. The result was that after the accord of those years, the trade unionists in this country had no reason whatever for belonging to a union. Their wages were negotiated between Kelty and Keating. They were based on national productivity. They had nothing to do with skills. And they got a 2 or 3% increase in exchange for abandoning all of their hard-won working conditions of the previous century. And sooner or later, the workers of Australia said, this is ridiculous. What am I paying union dues for? And they began to leave in droves. If you want to know why, the union movement has gone from 50% of the workforce to 18%. That's why. A lot of other factors came into it too. Part of the cultural changes were the abandonment of full-time employment and the establishment of a great variety of different forms of casual part-time employment and precarious employment. The unions didn't recognise it, made no attempt to recruit those people, and still don't. The result is those unionists cannot join a union. Union structures won't accept them. So it was a chaotic time, and the slide into the present train wrecks politically began then. That's in fact what happened. One could go on all night about this. The question is, can that position be reversed? Now, one of the things that was done to try and stem the tide from Labour was the establishment, like Graham Richardson, of factions in the party, and allegedly to stop another DLP split. It was started at a time when the DLP split was over. But factions had a big advantage for the apparatchiks in the party and the trade unions. It guaranteed that in future all parliamentary positions would be held by factional leaders. All trade union positions would be held by factional leaders. And the union movement would be mobilised not to fight for the workers, but to fight for whatever faction that union was aligned with. And if you want to know what the underlying causes of the scandal of the HSU is, that's it. And they became the centrepiece of right-wing factionalism in New South Wales. And they, if they were registered, that still would be. It was a scandalous union. I don't want to go into it. The peccadilloes of union officials in the HSU are a matter for them to determine before the courts. In of you without fault can criticise them. But you cannot overlook the fact that the union itself was guilty, not just the officials. Today, in Pitt Street, there was a mass demonstration of ambulance officers outside the HSU offices, demanding the right to be heard as a trade union. And, of course, they had very good reason for saying this, because all the ambulance officers on the street are in this their own union called EMSPAR, Emergency Medical Salary Union. But the HSU is the registered union to cover ambulance officers. And the HSU says, you're a breakaway union. You won't be recognised. We've had no members left in the HS, in the ambulance service, but we're not letting you in. That's the kind of Savonian bog that it is bedeviling the union movement. Of course, on the way to explain the hostility, might be mentioned that the HSU went to court before the Industrial Commission 18 months ago and applied for a wage reduction for ambulance officers in the order of $30,000 a year. Now, to none of you, $30,000 a year may mean nothing, but to a blue-collar worker, $30,000 a year is a lot of money. And to have their own union use their fees to go to court to reduce their wages says you something about the sect into which the union movement has gone. One could go on with stories like that. Oh, no wonder they were demonstrating in Pitt Street.
Can you please hold the microphone, please?
Yes, all right. The what's to be done? Now, the position with the Labour Party, I think, is not that difficult. Senator Faulkner wrote a long report as to what the Labour Party needed to do to regain office. But it included a lot of very, very radical reforms, inclusiveness. Anybody not in the other political parties is entitled to be recruited as a member of the Labour Party. The party should be organised not on an electorate basis, but on the basis of wherever there are people, there should be a Labour Party branch in this building, another one in any of the hospitals. RBA should have a branch. All of the, wherever you've got a collection of workers, you should have a Labour Party branch. They should be comprised of any gender, any age, anything. Wherever you've got them, the Labour Party has to move out into from its exclusive thing into an inclusive thing. And its policies have to reflect that. Its policies have to be as radical as any policies are. And if you open the membership and have the membership electing their parliamentary leaders, electing their leaders, you begin to get a form of reform that could survive. For the trade union movement, it's different. The trade union movement has to get rid of two constraints. It has to get rid of its obsession with recruiting workers only who work under a contract of employment. That's ridiculous. Most workers nowadays don't work under a contract of employment. They work under bailment, independent contract, precarious employment, any one of dozens of other forms of employment that the union movement will not enrol. The union movement has to get rid of that constraint on its right to recruit unionists. And it also has to get rid of the constraint that comes from registration. If they're registered to cover this class of worker, that's no reason why a union can't move outside of that registration and recruit any workers they like. Freedom of association has yet to be abolished in this country, and it requires very little tinkering to do that. The union movement has to recover its militant and its structural roots. In the early days of Australia, very, very few workers were worked under a contract of employment. They worked in buddy gangs and all sorts of arrangements. The union movement accepted them. A worker is a worker is a worker. That's how you determine who is a unionist. And wherever workers gather in a collective, whether it's registered, whether it's not, whether it's of permanent employment or not, where workers are gathered in a collective looking after their own interests, they're a union. And they should be recognised as a union. It's radical, anarchic, if you like. But unless that's done, the union movement can't move back from 18% of the workers back to the 50+ that it once had. Now let me finish by saying one thing. There is a bigger fight than that with which I would not expect to get unanimous support. That is to say, the union movement and the Labour Party can forge a balance between them. I see, I don't believe unions should be affiliated with the ALP. They should have their own conference. And do you know what? Many in the Labour Party would support that. But I think it's necessary as much for the unions as it is for the Labour Party. The ALP is led in the saddle of the union movement. But both of them can come together in a great fight against economism. Managerial economism replaced capitalism in the counterculture of the 60s, not often recognised. But where before shareholders were people, now they're institutions. And those institutions are the power sources in our society. The people who run those collective financial institutions run Australia. Never mind anyone else. If a manager of a business can get a $5 million pay rise on one day, and the next morning yawn when he wakes up, picks up the phone and closes down a national airline without board approval, that's the limit of managerial power, I'd like to think. Managers see no limit on their power, and until Labour and the unions combine together to remove managerial economism as the social and political philosophy of a country, we won't get anywhere. And anyway, now, Jared, I know you keep a close watch on time.
You're right on time.
So I'm right on time.
Thank you, Jim.
So we got Cassandra Pybus. I'm sorry, Cassandra Wilkinson. I'm a bit... I'd mentioned before how we had Tarek Ali here, but I didn't expect him to come back in the form of Jim Mackin, so I'm a bit shocked. Cassandra.
Hi. I find myself in slightly a bind. I was raised always to be very polite and respectful to your elder colleagues, but I have to disagree most intensely with Mr. Mackin's comment, and I suspect with everything that Mr. Cavalier is about to say as well. Excuse me reading from notes, but I know that the Institute publishes what we come to say, and I've just come out of a very raw pre-selection, and I'm trying not to be bitter and twisted, so I've written my comments down, tried to keep the slander in check, and if I normally do try not to speak from notes, but I feel like it's important to be clear in what I intend to say this evening. So, yes, I worked for Christina, which was great, but I actually also am a businesswoman. I'm a partner in a social investment firm, and I run a software company. I'm a writer. I'm a founder of FBI Radio, which is a public access radio station with 250,000 listeners, which is considerably more readers than some of our broadsheets have at the moment. And I write a newspaper column. I used to be an executive director in the public service. I worked for Deloitte for a while. I have, I guess, experience outside of politics as well as in, and I make this point not just to show off, but because when the party started to say a little while ago, we really need to look outside the professional political class, we really need to look outside the union movement for our candidates, I did vainly hope that the people they were talking about might be me. And it turns out, at least for now, it isn't. So I can now add to my credentials that uncomfortable suffix failed candidate. Although I take comfort that technically John Howard is also a failed candidate, having lost his very last election, although having done rather better in advance of it than I have so far in my career as a politician. So I have been examining the question of where to for Labour and do I fit here and all of the very kind invitations that I got from the Pirate Party and the Liberal Party and the Liberal Democrats over the last couple of weeks asking why someone from the Labour Party would campaign on high density and economic deregulation, and was I sure that I had read the sign on the way in to joining the Labour Party. So I guess if the Labour Party is the wrong party for me, I've wasted most of my adult life on a mistake, albeit one that gave me quite an excellent husband and a good living. In my early 20s, having quit resistance, I joined the Labour Party of Paul Keating, having studied economics and philosophy at university, clearly with my mind on a practical job somewhere. I had become obsessed with John Stuart Mill and the liberal economists, but I saw Labour as balancing that with a small s socialism for the new century. I got a call one day from my friend's mother's ex-husband, who said to me, "You're always banging on about changing the world. Would you like to come and help?" And I got on a plane and went down to Canberra and went to work for Senator Tom Wheelwright. I was 23 years old, and it was probably the last year of my life that I thought that I could devote myself to a Prime Minister who was going to save us all with tariff reform and arts policy. That seemed a full political landscape to me at the time. Our creative nation and economic deregulation was everything I wanted to be involved with. So I quit my band and went to work for the Labor government in Canberra. And I guess Sydney lost Raymond Luxury Yacht, our power pop band, but the country lost probably the last Prime Minister who had the guts to tell us that we needed to toughen up, start saving, get competitive, or be left behind in a globalising economy. Since then, politics, regardless of many of the bold stances taken by John Howard and Rudd and Gillard at various points, has largely become an exercise in reassuring everyone that they're doing it tough, regardless of how well the accounts look, and assuring them that they deserve more of a share of other people's money. The Liberals have embraced quite status policies. Certainly they support Medicare these days, family payments, the large system of state intervention in family life and school and health care, and are talking about having nationalised dental care, bipartisan support for disability insurance, even on economics, with the Libs supporting car industry subsidies, certain kinds of tariffs. Really, the carbon tax and the mining taxes are probably the only significant differences in terms of economic policy at the moment. But I guess I've seen Labor turning itself, since I joined, back into a party of big government socialism, having opened up the bonsai economy, having engineered the national electricity market, having created sustainable funding for higher education through HECS, and significantly impacting, deregulating centralised wage setting through enterprise bargaining. We're now in a coalition with Greens and agrarian socialists, renationalising communications infrastructure, building an internet firewall to censor the entire country, and a raft of new environmental, financial and industrial regulations, all of which put brakes on the businesses who generate the taxes that pay for everything else. Worst of all, the party that once represented the working class, certainly my grandparents who raised us all to be Labour, accounts for itself principally to enfranchise middle-class voters in the inner cities. Wales occupy time and talent that could be applied to flatlining literacy rates or the still unfinished task of national health reform. Cows have been treated as constituents while the workers and businesses who sell them became collateral damage in the battle for hearts and minds of an overserviced middle class. And for every marginal issue, a lobby group has grown up. And every political party and politician without sufficient spine is at the mercy of these interest groups now. So that until we can say no to saving White Pointer sharks and say no to saving another car factory that can't possibly survive much longer, instead of saying, actually, we haven't finished the Pacific Highway yet. Actually, we don't have enough dentists at the moment. And actually, there's a lot of kids in jail who ought not be there. We have not run out of sufficient numbers of real problems to start indulging the preoccupations of wealthy urban middle-class people who care about preserving sharks. So my transformation, I guess, from young socialist, I was plucked out of trees in high school trying to save the old growth forest, into, I guess, a smaller liberal, very much an economic rationalist, Paul Keating acolyte, was largely influenced by the work that I did to build FBI. We established our radio station with no government money, and it became very clear to me that social capital could be built faster with private enterprise and civil society institutions. and I certainly wasn't going to wait for the Australia Council to give us permission to make any noise. We raised more than $1 million out of private venture capital to get our radio station started, and in the process, I guess I became a Labor capitalist. We raised money, we gave the Vines their first start, Wolf Mother and the Presets, all of whom have become massive international success stories for Australia and Australian music. And we took the punk rock attitude, we were DIY about social capital, which made me very sceptical when during my day job, more and more and more social capital organisations claimed that there was nothing they could do without government help, and every single one of them, having identified anything worth doing, insisted that were it worth doing, then it must be worth doing by government. People in power essentially became the captives of these groups. Most ministers, and I dropped in and out of political advising work over a period of 15 years, coming back every time I swore I would not, and most ministers that I saw eventually became captured by the interest groups within their industries who traded their political friendship for a seat at the government banquet. And those in power became concerned more with carving up the pie than in growing the pie, which had been the mantra in the late 80s for Labor. Most of our senior politicians today, in fact, have barely any literacy in economics at all. There isn't a Button or a Walsh, let alone a Keating among them. I recently heard a senior minister say that the current cabinet in Canberra is the equal of any Labor has sent to Canberra. I assume that he either was trying to build morale or doesn't read, but I leave that to you to judge. And it wasn't just forgetting that swallowed Labor after Keating. It was complete repudiation of the massive increase in living standards that had been achieved by opening up the economy and reforming it and focusing on national productivity. Keating wrote a prescient letter to the now opposition leader John Robertson as he was trashing Maurice Yemmer's electricity reforms. And that letter, which went viral fairly swiftly, essentially said that once Robertson had finished humiliating Yemmer at the party conference, the government could only go one direction, which was swiftly down, and that the eventual defeat that would come would leave those MPs who lost their seats hanging around his neck like corpses. So I declare here two interests, that Michael Costa was, if unwillingly and begrudgingly, my mentor, and secondly, that one of those MPs whose corpses hangs around the neck of Mr. Robertson was my husband, whose marginal Labor seat has become a very safe Liberal seat. In the struggle for Labor's soul, despite the rhetoric inside the Labor Party that says the economic rationalists won, in fact it is the socialists who have the upper hand, socialists within the right faction as well as socialists within the left, and in fact there's almost no one left in Centre Unity who actually has a centrist or mainstream market-driven economic framework. In fact, the right in the party is essentially a conservative socialist to the left's progressive socialist, and it's only really issues like gay marriage that are left between them, as they're both essentially staffed by professional trade unionists and political staffers now. Our split from our legacy of economic reform really came to a crux in the Rudd monthly essay, where Rudd, who had declared himself for many years an economic rationalist, market-driven, a social democrat, a socialist, who had been in the right-wing think tank milieu for many years, went to the monthly and essentially said that capitalism has failed, that markets don't work, that the time for socialist and statist policies had come again. This is the Rudd who, in Simon Benson's book Betrayal, reputedly told Yemmer back during the Robertson crisis that once he was in power, he and Yemmer would F them together. I feel like I can't use that word in this very posh surrounds here. So my view, I guess, and rumours certainly has it that Mr. Rudd will be back shortly, is that he may well be better placed than Gillard to bring Labor up to the fight with Tony Abbott. He is certainly no better place to resolve the question of the struggle for Labor's soul. I joined Centre Unity because I believed that the Hawke-Keating agenda lifted prosperity for the poorest and the weakest, and that as my father, who was once an anarchist communist during the 1968 period we've just heard about, said to me, well, I guess, dear, that if you're going to redistribute the wealth, somebody probably has to create it. And to me, that was the point. That was the point of Hawke-Keating. It was not because we think it's great for people to be rich, but because the rising tide that lifts all boats begins with rising prosperity, and that is what everything is based on. And in my final remark, I guess I've come full circle to Keating's view again, that what it boils down to, he said, as he criticised the Balmain basket weavers, is that it'll be all about wider nature strips, more trees, and we'll all make wicker baskets in Balmain, and we'll all live in renovated terraces in Balmain, and we'll have the arts and craft shops, and everything else is bad and evil. And he said at the time, these people are trying to make my party into something that it's not. That's why I'll never abandon ship and never let those people capture it. I think Mark Latham is the only post-Keating leader in the Labor Party who is able to articulate that struggle that grips us now, the struggle between the socialist middle class and the aspirant working class. And in that struggle, I continue to side with those who believe that they have a right to a job and not a social worker. I side with those who have not yet gained enough comforts to trade them for the approval of Greenpeace. And I side, in short, with the people who still need us most.
Many thanks to Cassandra Wilkerson. It is quite a lively night, so we're off with Rodney Cavalier. Rodney.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to begin by congratulating Jim Mackin on his splendid book. He honoured me by allowing me to read it in manuscript. I'm agog as I reflect that the most rabid of the industrial groupers, the movement operatives and the founders of the DLP were, by any objective standard, well to the left of the ALP left in 2012. That is how far to the right our politics has shifted. Jim has put forward a serious and credible solution on how Labor brings to an end union control of its governance. Unless union control ends, nothing changes. Union control is not going to end, not by any self-action by the ALP. It won't happen without legislative intervention and the weapon of democracy. So nothing will change, and for that reason, Labor's doomed. I was so entranced by the subtitle of... I was so entranced by the homage to Lenin in the title of Jim's book that I overlooked the silliness, with respect, Jim, of your subtitle. If I'd noticed, I would have observed to the author, as I've observed to Jared privately, that there is no struggle, there is no soul, there is no movement. Dealing with the three noun seriatim, I contend that one, struggle. The right has incorporated the left. Not since 1986 has there been any meaningful contest between right and left. Instead of competing for control and who defines the guiding philosophy of the party, when the Cold War ended, the faction leaderships entered into conscious collaboration to shut out the membership and all bar those who offer liege service to the leadership, so they carved the spoils between themselves and their liege men. The state pre-selections of 2003 was an especially scurvy moment. Soul, with the consequence that Labor forfeited a belief system and binding values. It's probably all three speakers are in agreement on that, though we have different expectations about what they might be, but I don't think you would have any one of the E3 assert Labor has binding values or a belief system. There is no position on any issue from one end of the spectrum to the other that Labor cannot occupy. The exemplar is climate change, where we took both polar extremes. One, it was the great moral challenge, then it was not a matter to be addressed. And we've taken two points in between. That's what happens when a party lacks a soul. And movement, three. How can there be a movement when nothing much is moving? Unions are down to 8% of the electorate, affiliated unions. Over 150 branches have folded in New South Wales. Few of the remainder, which I assert is not many over 100, maybe 200, could pass a breath on the mirror test. There might be 500 activists remaining. Forget any numbers cast in a pre-selection. So Labor is not a movement, it's a hollow. The absence of any meaningful involvement by the ALP in the 2007 federal election and since tells you all you need to know about the struggle for the soul of a party. It was resolved by the separation of parliamentary parties into spaceships that roam the galaxies, remote and isolated from earthly contact, certainly with the ALP and the community, touching base only on set piece occasions like a conference. The leader has become a godhead. To understand Labor's governance, think beyond Westminster and think beyond now. Go back to the Tudors. The rough, rude democracy of Australian Labor has been supplanted by absolute fealty to the godhead leader whose word is binding, from whom all authority flows. The 2011 conference, or the one 2 years before it, were particularly egregious examples of obeisance to a godhead. The godhead provides all and everything of what Labor stands for. Loyalty is absolute up to the moment the godhead is proposed for an alternative, after which the preceding loyalty transfers, exactly like European monarchy in the Middle Ages. Jim Mackin, I was pleased to read, is a disciple of Fernand Braudel. So was Jack Ferguson, the finest person I've ever known in public office. Braudel was the founder of the school of longue durée. Any of his works are essential to understand any society at any time. And what Braudel taught, of which Jim Mackin is an exemplar, is that everything in politics is structure. Structure is everything. Repeat those six words whenever you look at a political equation, you will never, ever go wrong. Now, efforts at limited reform at the most recent national conference were rejected for transparently self-interested reasons. The factions, both of the labels, could not pretend that the reason is other than a distrust of democracy. I wrote in 2001 that the caucus just elected was the weakest in the history of Federation. That degeneration continued in 04, 07 and 2010. Labor is incapable of renewal or drawing on the broad talents of the Labor constituency because it has become a closed shop, controlled and managed by a political class. Everything that was wrong in 2001 has become a lot worse, a lot worse. The potential Labor catchment is a shadow of what it was in numbers and in quality. By political class, I mean union officials, ministerial parliamentary staffs, party employees, and there are also mercenaries involved in public relations, polling and fundraising. The other side of politics has developed a political class which has equivalents in the think tanks and lobby groups for industry. The Libs are catching up fast. The aspirants for Parliament are increasingly an operative for a faction of Labor or the Liberals, and the Greens are developing the same way. Factional operatives are the members of the only class which has survived into this century, the political class. And I'm being very precise by what I mean when I say class. I'm employing a Marxist definition because the political class is conscious of each other, acts in concert, and acts in self-interest. The mud punters, however, the people of Australia, they've worked out the foibles, shortcomings, the strengths of leaders, the weaknesses of leaders, potential leaders, before the media get there, and they always do. Well before. The people worked out they did not like Kay Rudd while the media and a caucus who hated him continued to treat him seriously. The punters have worked out there's something seriously wrong with the ALP. Now, I concede that party reform may not cut any ice as a coffee table topic or bar talk, but the problem is, in the absence of reform, the transfer of power to below, to a reasonable constituency, a reasonable catchment, that is what has caused the delay, the decay in the quality of Labor's representation. And it's palpable. The punters do not necessarily know why the Labor Party is no longer for them, but they do know the Labor Party is not for them. New South Wales 2011 is the way of the future. You wouldn't have thought you would see a defeat come without tears being shed. Might have happened in local instances for candidates loved and admired, but there was a complete lack of tears about the fall of that government. That will be the way of the future. So serious is the decay that I assert as an axiom that Labor cannot produce another Keating or Whitlam. I didn't even begin to dream of a Curtin or Chifley. Leaders in the past came from below. They'd been branch operatives, localists. They had an assured sense of community. They were not anointed because of connection. They had to appeal to the unwashed in private lounge rooms and 1,000 branch meetings and electorate councils to get ahead. Past leaders encountered opposition which did not cease, not even when they became high and mighty as leaders. Gough Whitlam had to endure, most of the time he was member for Werriwa, into his leadership of the opposition, the serried ranks of a well-organised opposition of when there was a left in Werriwa, trying to take his head off, or in his absence, Margaret's head off, for most of the time that he was the member. That was the way it was. Caucus meetings savaged leaders as appropriate, as did ALP conferences. Past leaders entered the leadership with the qualities of a leader forged by a career based on struggle and competition, not being cosseted and not being obeyed. The ALP used to be a perfect training ground for leadership of the nation. Rough it was, brutal, racist, parochial, misogynous, anti-intellectual, a culture of limited expectation. All of that and so much else that was deplorable, yet each caucus possessed people, about six in number, maybe a bit more, worthy of Australia. Any one of that six could have been a leader. Not now. Emerging from all that were wrong were internationalists, civil libertarians, people with convictions unshakable, leaders profoundly respectful of who put them there and sustained them, trade union leaders who came from a background of work and struggle. Whatever its faults and shortcomings, Labor's nursery worked in enough electorates, in enough workplaces, for Australian Labor to produce people worthy of the nation's leadership. Not so a leadership drawn exclusively from the political class, anointed by the political class to act in the interests of the political class. Parliamentary leadership cannot mask what is not there, as the Rudd experiment showed. Character is what you bring to office. It's not a tray that's devised in a workshop, an elixir brewed by a focus group. Such people, such narrowness, may certainly win an election, may win an election in the future, but it cannot provide good government, and it will not be convincing for long. Fewer than 500 people, denizens all of the political class, have any chance of getting pre-selected for anything winnable. I emphasise winnable. The 500 are connected, if not related, to each other. It's easier for a person of humble background to use education and hard work to enter the leadership of the ASX 200 companies than it is to crack a safe Labor seat. That is one reason the safe seats are becoming scarcer and less safe. In the old BHP culture, connection was everything. Now it scarcely matters. Connections of blood, marriage and friendship are everything in the modern ALP. For contemporary Labor to produce a leader worthy of Australia is about as likely as Bermuda winning Olympic gold. These are simple actuarial facts. The impulse to panic that envelops parliamentary Labor periodically is a consequence of a parliamentary grouping living inside a spaceship. There is no anchor, there is no reference points, there's nothing to cling to, certainly not to the notion of loyalty. Loyalty to what? Not to the leader, a disposable entity whose survival depends on the perception he or she can win the next election. Not to a set of principles or beliefs, since modern Labor is not troubled by such matters. Not to the party membership, of whom there are so few, and those few don't get to determine whether you stay there or not. If the party appears to be directionless, it's because it's lacking direction. Such a party exists solely to win elections. The Labor project has come to an end. I base my view not on the primary vote or seats held or the two-party preferred, but because you cannot be a mainstream party if you cannot put an army in the field. If, for example, you can't staff polling booths on election day. I think a good deal of the intellectual core of what Jim is writing about is what I call the Labor project. By Labor project, I mean those first fond hopes at the party's founding in 1891 that Labor's existence would be transformative. Labor was going to be different and better and exist for the advancement of working people and the dispossessed. In one sense, over 100 years plus, Labor killed itself by reason of its success in education and housing. Labor enriched its support base, it housed people who could afford houses and made possible home ownership and educated their children. They should be people who could not afford houses. The beneficiaries of a century of good Labor decided they did not need Labor. That's the benign explanation. The less kind view is that the party became a machine to deliver jobs and favours to the political class, a rotten affair that exists solely to provide careers. The professionalisation of politics gave birth to the political class. When it's recognised that Labor is entering a long midnight, and I mean a long, long midnight, the ambitious will go elsewhere. But Labor's already gone. The matter of a death of a party calling itself Labor is not really in dispute. In most of Australia, certainly in rural and regional Australia, Labor does not exist. The collapse beyond Sydney, the collapse in the bush when Labor got most of its seats in 1901, the first federal election, it has now embraced the arc of the party's birth. The founding branches of the party, where the first leagues came into existence, in Glebe and Redfern, where as recently as the 1990s, there were four branches in Glebe and four branches in Redfern. As recently as the 1970s, there was over 1,000 members in both. And I mean real members, people who turned up at meetings, had set-piece battles. An annual general meeting with 36 positions vacant would have 72 at least nominations and a ballot for everything, with a general returning officer and scrutineers and appeals. And it would then continue for the next 11 meetings, one year after another. Where there were four branches in Glebe, there became two, there became one, and a few months ago, there became none. There is no Labor Party presence in Glebe or Redfern. It is scarce credible. 150 branches have folded elsewhere. The ALP does not pass a breath in the mirror test in most of the 100 or so branches that remain. I can name branches that have not handed back their charter, where four or five good people meet, and it's in no one's interest to close them down. That's the reality. An audit would be truly shocking. If the Labor Party was the New South Wales Bowling Club Association, our bowling greens would be weeds and divots. Labor has to change its structure. It has to change its identity. Structure is everything. Everything is structure. Because we have hit a ceiling of around 35%. And it's not going to go up from there. It's going to go in one direction. But while ever parliamentary Labor retains 25% of the primary vote, it stands in the way of anything else emerging. Tony Blair, no less, who had connections with Australia, when he was making his run for the UK Labor leadership, at the University of Adelaide, of all places, gave a speech about the arithmetic of a new pulse emerging and explained in brutally honest terms why he was sticking with Labor, which was while Labor stayed above 25%, nothing else could emerge. So he wasn't leaving it. That's a powerful reason, and arithmetic is the major reason why Labor remains, is the reason that Labor will remain the opposition for some time yet to come. The Labor project is over, but the worst kind of Labor Party remains, and that remainder is capable of electing members of Parliament in ever fewer places. While ever a brand called Labor can elect members of Parliament, the brand will endure. A party without values, reduced to a cameo, playing a charade of tax cuts and budgets in surplus, unwilling to achieve a revenue base for the public sector that will rebuild the nation and fund adequately schools, universities and hospitals. Talking about nothing more than the tax base that was there in 1996. Brand Labor cannot even bring itself to defend the role of government as a positive force in the lives of the Australian people. Neither Kay Rudd nor Jay Gillard were prepared to declare themselves in 2007 to have a bias in favour of public or private. That silence represents the ghost whispers of the Australian Labor Project. These years will become known to history as the period in which the political parties, plural, betrayed Australia, all of them. Give thanks for the independent culture and the vigour of the Reserve Bank, the Australian Taxation Office, the Bureau of Census and Statistics, the Australian Electoral Commission, the National Library and our collecting institutions. Give thanks for an independent judiciary, the rule of law and a military which accepts civilian authority. Civil society depends on strong institutions with a powerful institutional culture. The political parties of contemporary Australia are not among those institutions.
Well, thanks to all our speakers, and particularly for keeping to time. So we've got till no later than 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. We'll probably finish a bit before that. When I introduce our speakers, I should have mentioned that Cassandra Wilkinson was the unsuccessful in the Labor pre-selection for the city of mayor of Sydney. She mentioned that herself. I should also mention that Rodney Cavalier, of course, was the senior minister in the Rann and Unsworth Labor government in New South Wales of recent memory. First of all, thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this wonderful and environmentally conscious building that they've let us have tonight, so we're very grateful for that. And so we come to questions and discussion. If I just get everyone to come and stand here, Jim's got a voice problem, so he stands in front of the microphone here, and the others come in. I'll start off with Jim and Cassandra, because Rodney has essentially concluded. By the way, I think we've had three very lively presentations, but Rodney's concluded his presentation by saying that Labour will hold at least 25% of the vote and therefore will remain a party, if not the Labour project. But what does Jim Macken and Cassandra Wilkinson think about Labour's prospects of survival, or do they think it might be replaced by another party, a party from the left, presumably? So, Jim, what do you think, and Cassandra? And then you can all assemble yourselves around here. Okay.
Thank you, Jared. Look, as far as I can see, the way back has to start with a complete separation of the union movement from the branches of the ALP, and it is possible then to construct a mass movement of workers throughout the tribal if you get rid of the constraints of the common law contract and registration. Let me put this to you. Why shouldn't there be a Dungog workers' union? Why shouldn't there be a Thangarau workers' union? Why should unions always be based on the performance of a job? Why not on a locality basis? Why not think laterally and see that you can build a trade union movement based on anybody who works, man, woman or child, student or otherwise, and from that you can get a Labour Party of the past, a project party, a party, if you like, that will respect human rights. I see Labour essentially returning to being a humanist party. It's not a party for developers, big businessmen, banks or whatever. It's got to be a party of the people. There should be a Labour Party branch in every refugee centre, in every place where there are anybody. I wouldn't mind Labour Party branches in our prisons. Then people do. There is no limit to what you can go if you accept the unity of the workers.
Okay, that's fine. So you're saying Labour can survive and can grow again. Cassandra, can you just pass me his book? Jim's book.
Pat, who's here this evening as one of our hosts, representing our host, Clayton Utes, would probably remember that I vainly hoped to many of my colleagues as we reached the end of days in the Keneally government that with the imminent prospect of certain death, that people would, you know, just free themselves up and you know, imagine if you only had a week to live, what would you do with 350,000 public servants and $40 billion of other people's money? Why not, you know, why not just express yourself? This is a roundabout way of coming to saying, I don't know if 25% is a magic number or not, but there, in my experience, there is no number so small that the professional political class and their friends, cousins, contemporaries, allies at the heads of the union movement will not convince themselves that with one more clever tactic and one more focus group and one more ploy for the heartland and one more save the furniture exercise that they can't protect their current privileges or at least preserve themselves to fight another day. And the cynicism that grips the people who are in charge of both movements is profoundly disturbing at the moment. And I absolutely agree that the unions and the Labour Party need to split as a precondition for rebirth. I was one of those people who hoped that the Greens would suck away the communists from our party and suck away the radical left-wing trade unions. That hasn't happened. In fact, what happened was a lot of leftists in the party went and professionalised the Greens and have dragged them towards the mainstream left, and the Labour Party decided to fight back for the same voters, dragged our entire party towards the left again. What Australia needs and what I feel the Labour Party needs to reclaim is to be a party of the centre, to be a party of, you know, what's variously being called the reforming centre, the radical centre, to be a party that embraces markets, not because we like people to own yachts particularly, but because, as Paul Keating said, markets are simply a good way to get a lot of things done. I guess I feel like the party needs to have these conversations. At the moment, it's in a state of denial about the essential fractures that it needs to come to terms with.
Thanks, Sandra. Yeah, you can. Before, as you're getting up, I should have said that we've got Janet Groney's got copies of Jim Macken's book, What Is to Be Done? The Struggle for the Soul of the Labour Movement, up the back. So, Rodney? Yeah.
Yes. I agree with pretty well a good deal. Cassandra said there's no number below which these people won't delude themselves. I suspect you're right, Cassandra, but I do think there is a number. That is, when Labor no longer polls a Senate quota and there's no longer an escape route for the General Secretary of the day, then it will be a crisis.
Senate quota is about 13% thereabouts.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Well, there you go. So, question, don't stand up. It's a question here. Yep.
Look, Julie Macken, Communications Director of Greenpeace, got to tell you, Cassandra, you're in no risk of getting any of that approval, so you don't need to sweat about it. But I would be interested to hear from Rodney. You kind of drew a really pretty harrowing picture. Do you see signs of hope anywhere, within Labor or without?
Well, firstly, Cassandra, do you want to respond to that? And then we'll go to Rodney. But can I encourage you to stay around here? If you all hang around the microphone, that's the best way to be.
Can I tell you why people can't afford houses in Sydney? The average amount that government intrusion has added to the cost of a house in New South Wales is $160,000 per block. All of that can be sheeted home to environmental and planning legislation, where we thought that socialist central planners could design people into better systems by imposing on them conditions for living, which came at public expense. We kidded ourselves in government that we could make everyone cleaner and greener and nicer, but we hadn't actually solved the basic problems. There are towns in New South Wales with no sewerage. There are kids in New South Wales with no foster carers. The dilettante concerns of the inner city middle class don't concern me, and if Greenpeace doesn't like it, I just take that as a badge of honour.
Cassandra, Rodney, the second part of the question was directed to you, or the comment was directed to you.
Which is, do I see any cause for hope?
Within Labor or without, anywhere.
I don't see any chance of Labor reforming itself. I find myself in the curious position of being the most pro-union of these three, because these two want to consign the unions to outer darkness. I want to reduce them to 8% of the conference floor. Then I can say, only if that happens, or what they say happens, can there be any chance of change. Jared's friends in the coalition can do something by legislative changes that have compulsory plebiscite before a union can affiliate. I suggest very few unions other than the MUA would vote positively for affiliation with the ALP, and there can be a democracy test about public funding. Why should your tax dollars go to the Labor Party, which is not run on democratic lines? So unless a party is run by its own membership and can demonstrate that to a court, it shouldn't get any tax dollars. So I see a whole lot of bleakness before I can see any changes. Then my belief is, strong belief is, that if the party was opened up to everyone who subscribed to Labor values, as broad as from Jim Macken and me through to Cassandra, if everyone could see a point in belonging to the Labor Party, then a fair dinkum contest should take place, and the winner will win on these and lose on those. The contest itself is beneficial and enhances all the participants.
Rodney, just state it. Okay. Now, right. So there's a question, Lindsay. Okay. Now, who's it to? Anyone?
To the three of them. I've heard a lot of speakers over the years talk about the future of the Labor Party, and even tonight, half the people, there's one view that it's too left-wing, there's another view that it's too right-wing, and that it's lost its philosophy. And if what Jim says is right, maybe the world has changed, but the Labor Party is incapable of changing just because people have changed and, for whatever reason, become more independent, become more capitalists. And is there a possibility that our two-party system may go the American way and both parties are parties of the right and there is no party that really represents organised labour, because organised labour is not worth representing, and that on the other extreme, which the Americans don't have, there is a left-wing party that is the Greens, and the Labour Party, like the Whigs, in England, just went the way of the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So right or wrong, you can't save it because it's inherently an inherent contradiction.
So a quick response to the proposition that maybe Australia will go like the United States for two right of centre parties and a Greens movement. So first up, Rodney, then Cassandra, then Jim. Rodney?
I believe we're already there. And the unions, the affiliated trade unions, are the conservative ballast of the party. That's why the coalition will not do anything about union control. It gives, one, makes the Labor Party conservative, and two, guarantees the coalition has a massive electoral advantage in every contest. They must look aside to the other side of the house and see so many who came from there and be quietly pleased or vocally pleased. So I think we're already there.
So we go, Ronnie, just keep standing up.
Sorry.
Okay, now Cassandra, and then we'll go to Jim. Yeah?
So I, at the risk of opening up a discussion maybe for a cup of tea afterwards or something, I actually don't think left-right is exactly the correct prism here. I think there's a liberal-illiberal, and there is actually no party of smaller liberalism in this country anymore. The Conservatives are as statist as Labor. You know, their particular constituencies are different, but, you know, there really isn't... That, you know, say we're all capitalists now. I don't think either party has the courage to say that or work out what to do with it.
Jim?
I disagree with Rodney when he says that I can consign the unions to the outer darkness. I would put the unions at the centre of recovery. I would make them a old-fashioned, worker-based militant, if you like, worker collective, whether you call them a cooperative or anything else, and many of them were cooperative. Let me say this, I don't even believe that a strike is simply an industrial privilege. I think it is a human right, and that it should be preserved, and that nobody has the right to say to a worker, you would never go on strike, but the employer has the right to say he can sack you whenever he likes. I take it a step further into the militancy and the Australianism of the last century before last. It was a good period for workers.
Right, so, yeah.
Direct my question to Rodney. I was interested how he said Labor has improved the standard of workers by education and giving them housing. But when I look around my green friends, they tell me, yeah, my father was a coal miner, my grandfather's a coal miner. Now, they don't support the Labor Party, they support the Greens, and they really dislike people who are in the western suburbs and going to pokies.
Yes. Yep.
I'm not sure, other than deploring anyone who takes that energy, I'm not sure what you're asking me. The Labor Party, well, to be fair, the trade union movement was everything that Jim says before there was a Labor Party. It was a creative force. We can, not far from here, go to the fruits of what the trade union movement achieved as a collective force. The first Mechanics Institute, Schools of Arts, their lending libraries resulted in the State Library of New South Wales. Their trade schools resulted in the technical schools that became the Department of Technical Education and today is TAFE. It was the second plank of the first Labor Party platform was free, compulsory and secular education. And it was Labor's pressure from the crossbenchers that compelled the governments of New South Wales to offer a school in any community where there was enough children to warrant it, as few as seven. These are great achievements. And you could continue it into this century when the trade unions and the Labor Party founded the Rugby League.
Do you want to add to that, Tim? Let me go here. Yeah,
I was just wondering, I haven't grown up in Australia, and the Labor Party definition to me is an us and them. You're the party for the us against the them, the business managers as such. With the world, especially my generation, coming up to a point where it's entrepreneurial, aspirational, we start companies in high school. You've got blue-collar workers whose wives and kids are selling things on eBay. I'm wondering, is the Labor Party needing to redefine who a worker is, who us is, and can it be a party of the us and them? Because, I mean, for me, I want to be a manager of my company to build up my workers, to provide a lifestyle, which I have. And I'm wondering if that definition just because the nature of work has changed. And I would be interested in your definitions of us, them and worker.
I'm really pleased to get that. I run a small company. If my workforce went on strike, we'd be dead in a week. Yeah. And I started my first company at 20. I've been a director of three companies. I look at productivity and job security from a managerial perspective. It's been a long time since I washed dishes, but I did a lot of that when I was young. Part of the problem, I guess I want to make a comment in favour of managerial economism, as it's been variously called. What we nearly got to when Keating and Howard faced each other was the idea that there isn't really much of an us and them anymore. We are a large, diverse workforce. We are not principally in those places that had such poor working conditions that they relied on unions for their basic rights. Actually, what we should have is a contest, not between two parties who can claim to represent two different groups of people, because both of them need to represent all of us. In fact, what we should be arguing is better and worse approaches to literacy, better and worse approaches to managing the hospital system, competing public policy prescriptions for clear social objectives. You know, I go to events with Liberals and Democrats and Labour people. Effectively, what we all want is healthcare system that works effectively. We don't want dental shortages. We want housing made available. We want land supply fixed. These are not matters of philosophy. They are matters of practical, tactical responses by government at opportunity costs with public money. What gets written off as economic rationalism is simply the realisation that public money can only be spent once, that opportunity cost is the principal challenge of government. The fact that we have so few economically lucid politicians on either side at the moment is the great tragedy, you know, and pretending that a philosophy either of the free market and opportunity on the Liberal side or of equity, justice, sunshine and children on the Labor side can answer the question of how the hell do you get Aboriginal children to school is just a convenient nonsense that papers over the inadequacy of the policy debate going on.
Jim, do you want to defend the Jim, do you want to defend the industrial workers of the world? Do you want to?
It's too late, Jared. But let me say this about managerial economism. It's the first time in the history of the world that things, incorporeal things, things like this desk, have been put in charge of human beings and treat them with contempt, such contempt that they refer to them as a human resource. And when the unions complained about being called a human resource, even the daily newspapers supported the unions. Managerial economists, the only two people who oppose it are myself and the late Bob. No one else seems to recognise the dangers by which an institution can give orders to control the lives of human beings. They don't seem to see anything wrong with it, but I certainly do. I think it's a system that should be overturned.
That does sound like the IWW.
A party pursuing a course of us and them is on the road to ruin. The rhetoric of successful leaders who become Prime Ministers and remain Prime Ministers is inclusive. Menzies' speech about the forgotten people was a speech of genius. Gough's speech at Blacktown in 1972 was the same, and it was building, however, not on some speechwriter had knocked out over the weekend. It was building on all of his thinking and the thinking, the collective thinking of the whole Labor movement in many ways since 1947. That's the difference with the basing your politics on pressure groups, focus groups, qualitative polling and guesswork.
Right, question here? Yes.
If I can ask Cassandra.
Should Cassandra come up here a second?
And Rodney also about one of Jim's points. And I think it follows on from the man in the check shirt point in a way. Labor reaching out to the precarious workers, the precariat as they were called in the New Left Review recently. Wonderful idea, but some of them want to be precarious. Possibly most of them don't. Can Labor reach any of them at all?
I guess I want to quickly correct what I think.
Can we just what's a precarious worker? How would you define that? You mean someone who's about to lose their job?
A precarious worker is somebody usually working for themselves, would like to work more regular hours or would like to earn more money, I imagine, driving a small white van frantically around the suburbs, trying to get from jobs.
So they're right, talking about a subcontractor
or someone who's
underemployed.
Yes, but it also sinks down to illegal immigrants in particular and them trying to work in large quantities like this.
So people who want to work and who aren't working who want to do more work. Okay. Right.
The big myth about the unions in the 60s and 70s was that workers had a great when the unions were in control of representing organised labour. This is nonsense. They protected a small number of privileged workers against the interests of the broad set of workers so that we had artificially high rates of pay for people who weren't productive enough to warrant them and massive unemployment on an inhumane scale for the rest of people who were locked out of those closed shops. Now, when I look at the role for the union movement now, I would love to see Labor and the unions focus there. And in fact, industrial relations policy under Labor has focused more on minimums, the establishment of Fair Work Australia. I think we can resolve those things, but we need to also be clear that a lot of people choose to be contractors. I have had difficulty recently convincing many of my staff to take permanent contracts. I've had people flat out refuse to take permanent contracts at the company that I run. I think that we need to be really clear that, generally speaking, most people with a decent education in this country can get a job. The pockets of unemployment are in places like the Illawarra, in Western New South Wales. They're in places where we have structural unemployment because, in part, government industry policies have done some things like propping up the Illawarra with subsidy after subsidy, supporting industries that had no realistic chance of surviving in the global economy with just enough public subsidy to stop them reforming or becoming competitive or innovative and getting long-term job security. And we encourage a culture of people not moving for work. We don't help capital be mobile. We have stamp duty attached to all of our properties so that people can't sell their house to move somewhere for a new job. I don't think we should conflate the problems of a small number of marginalised workers with a broad crisis across the economy. That's what people like the TWU do on those subcontractor campaigns.
Jim, do you want to make a comment on that? Oh, Rodney next.
Yep.
Yeah, Rodney. Yeah, okay, Rodney.
Jim's writing on this is right on the mark. I'd heard the phrase precarious worker before tonight. But a party that's first point of organisational principle is to be controlled lock, stock and dividend stream by just 15% of the workforce, 8% of the electorate, is a party that has no future. That to me is self-evident. The party should seek to represent anyone who works for a living, whether an employee or self-employed. The structure of the party excludes all those people who do not belong to unions affiliated with the ALP, which is essentially everyone in education and the public servants. Not quite everyone, but most people. All those people that don't belong to a union at all. The people who work at home. The self-employed. The people in new and emerging industries, some of which might be covered by what you're talking about, students and the retired, they're all excluded. That adds up to 92% of the Australian electorate. Sheer madness for a party to exclude from any meaningful role in its governance 92% of the electorate. The answer to what we're talking about, some of it is contained in Hume's book, but surely it is, Labor should be committed to a regime of law that protects the rights and dignity of everyone who works in any place.
Jim, just not too close to put on the pop.
That's right, I agree with everything that Rodney said. But look, let me say this. If a person wants to be a casual, good o, they can be a casual. But that should not stop them belonging to a union. And under the present system, they cannot belong to a union. Union structures won't admit them in. Precarious employment is nearly at 30% of the workforce. Those are people who work through labour hire firms, a pernicious form of employment. But the trade union movement can cater for them very effectively. If every major union had its own labour hire firm, there wouldn't be any non-unionism amongst the labour, the casuals and part-timers. That's not a nonsense. We did it in Newcastle. The Labour Council in Newcastle formed its own labour hire company. Our wages bill at the moment is $30 million a year. That's a lot of workers. $30 million a year. naturally they've got to be financial in their union, and they're the best workers up there. The employers only employ them, and the same could happen in here if it wasn't for the Labor Party's objection to labour hire firms being associated with the union.
Just before we go up the back, Jim, when you said before your views were supported by the Pope, you're talking about John Paul II, right?
Yeah.
Right, okay. It's a fair enough question because there are a number of popes, so we're talking about John Paul II. It's a serious point. Okay. And, yeah. Just speak up a bit. It's a question about the past splits in the Labour Party in the First World War, the 1930s and the 1950s, and if there's a disaster at the next election, how can Labour come back? And then the second question is, can the likes of Greg Combey and Bill Shorten, because of their background in the union movement, resolve some of these problems? So we start with you, Rodney, because you were mentioned in the question.
Right, it was very hard to hear you, Anne. Were you comparing electoral disasters of the 30s and 50s with the impending electoral disaster from which Labour recovered? Is that,
yes,
the burden that we...
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, after a terrible disaster, often parties can regroup. I mean, Menzies formed the Liberal Party after the disaster of 43. And although the First World War, in your writing, as you explained, the industrialists took over the party, is there any chance you could reverse all that now? And after all, union leaders like Bob Hall could be great inclusive leaders for Labour.
Well, an excellent question, Anne, and of course you, a very distinguished author, recently wrote a book about Joe Lyons and talked about what happened when the Nationalist Party, formed with Billy Hughes and the Conservatives at the time, collapsed in 1929. Something like that has to happen. You asked me about self-reform. No reform means anything unless it leads to the end of union control. And by union control, I mean union control. You have to reduce the proportion of unions on the floor of conference well below 50%, well below 20%, to something like their percentage of the workforce or their percentage of the electorate. That's not going to happen. Therefore, there will not be any self-reform. I said in the address, my approach is not based on the primary vote or seats won. It's based on the absence of an army in the field to contest. Now, I happen to bring along, because I thought I'd get a question like this, the Labor Daily Yearbook 1933, 1 year after the dismissal of Jack Lang. You go to this book and you will find that the Labor Party, in the midst of what we always look back on as a time of cataclysm and difficulty, that Labor had an ALP Tennis Association, an ALP Cricket Association and an ALP Vigoro Association. The cricket associations alone numbered 14 clubs, and I suspect there was more than one grade. Adding umpires, administrators, the Labor Party be good at supplying administrators, I assert that more people played cricket who were Labor Party members in the ALP Cricket Association in the 1930s than there are members of the Labor Party in those branches today, in the unlikely event there is a branch in those areas today.
Jim, do you want to make a comment, and then Cassandra? We're getting very close to the end now, so yeah. Yeah.
I've forgotten what the question was.
It doesn't really matter here tonight.
Look, the changes have to be radical. You can't just say, look, tinker with the edges, a little bit of democracy here and there, and leave the present structures unchanged. Look, it didn't even work for the churches. They couldn't change after 1968, and you had ministers and congregations leaving in floods. Now, the same applied to the ALP and the unions. You can build a mass movement of workers more easily than a mass movement of Labour Party members. But if you do it, you've got to get back to what Rodney said. The Labour Party has to be inclusive. It has to have cricket clubs, all sorts of women's groups, gay branches, whatever you like. Well, that's not so silly as it might sound, because I think there might be a lot more branches in King's Cross than there are gay branches. And we might man a few boots out there.
Do you want to make a comment?
It is frustrating. I don't know if Labour will take this opportunity to regroup. Michael Egan said at a speech I heard a couple of years ago, he said in 1968 everyone told him only a madman would join the ALP, they would never govern again. Now, it may be that what looks very bleak right now will change quickly. You know, none of us can say, and the Labour Party's been in worse. We've had worse. This is a flesh wound, one might say. But I come back to what I said before. I think the critical problem we have is that philosophy is no longer the answer, that we are no longer a society divided on class lines. Australia was always less that than the places from which we got our core political beliefs. But it's less that than ever now. We're a largely middle-class country. We have serious problems at the margins that we keep ignoring because those people at the margins are no longer spoken for by a party that associates itself with the disenfranchised and downtrodden. I guess I don't really care if that involves unions or cricket clubs or gay branches or anything. It's really about a fundamental return to the principle of debating ideas. We keep looking for structural solutions, we keep talking about branch structures, direct election, popular votes, plebiscites, you know, people behaving as if there are solutions that don't relate directly to the quality of ideas. And in fact, everything comes down to that. Gough Whitlam had a manifesto he called The Programme. It sounds slightly creepy, actually, to me now, but the point was he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He could see what was over the hillside that he was climbing. He could see every detail of what he wanted to do on the other side. Keating and Hawke had a very clear vision. They were confident in their readiness to govern because they thought long and hard about exactly what they wanted to do. Bob Hawke had written about it in his dissertations at Oxford. I mean, they had given thought. I actually take great inspiration from Alan Stockdale, who spent 6 months with Nigel Lawson preparing himself to govern Victoria as Treasurer, apprenticed himself to the Chancellor, put his platform together. He and Kennett had prepared every detail of what they wanted to do when they got in. And the issue for us is not structure, and it's not even mass or not mass, and it's certainly not philosophical. It's about having a group of leaders, small or large, utterly clear about what needs to be done. And that's why, despite the fact that I really hate public speaking, I keep having these discussions because internally in the party, all I want to find is a group of people who want to be very clear about what needs to be done.
Now, we've got 6 minutes. I've got two questions that got the call up, one up the back and one here. So I think we'll take the first two questions now, briefly, and we'll take a response. Yeah.
Okay. Sasha Blue, I'm a former Labor candidate and recently an elected Labor consent for putting clear policy proposals in the recent pre-selection. The clearest start there. And also, all three speakers said very interesting things. Question for Cassandra: how do we regain, if it's possible, the radical centre of politics that's been sorely missing since about 97, 96?
We're going to leave that for a minute, so we're going to take the question here.
Yeah, just quickly, how surreal is it that Labor is so unpopular despite having unemployment at 5%, inflation and interest rates both below 5%, something that a Liberal government would kill for? What's the disconnect, and is it still about the economy?
Okay, so we'll start off with Cassandra, and the question is, how can Labor regain the radical centre? And then there's also this question, which we'll, or you can start off with, and then we'll end up with Rodney and with Jim, about why is Labor so unpopular in view of the economic statistics. So, Cassandra.
It comes back to purpose again. We elected a Prime Minister who said he had a clear vision of what was over that hill and ran around the country in a bus saying, you know, he had knew the great moral challenges of our time, etc., etc. Then he repudiated his platform, he got thrown out. We will pay for that coup at the next election and there's nothing we can do about it. So that's the unemployment rate could go to 1% and that won't change. How do we reclaim the radical centre? I'm more convinced than ever that we developed within the party a culture of silence, that we were bullied with the most trivial of threats to be silent when poor quality candidates were elected. We were bought off for the most trivial of gifts in order to support groups in factions and power structures who offered nothing in the way of solutions for society. And I think this reform starts with people in the party being enraged to be represented by people who are not fit for the job. And it starts with all of us speaking up and refusing to be scared. I mean, you know, you look around the world, you think, look at what people suffer for speaking up politically. And what are we afraid of?
Yeah.
You know, that we might have trouble getting a job, that someone might write something rude about us in the newspaper, that, you know, that we might suffer some personal reputational slight. You know, we have to stop being so scared for so little reason.
Okay, so we go to Rodney and then we conclude with Jim.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I endorse what Cassandra said, and that recipe could apply equally to a party that wasn't ashamed to call itself part of the left. It wasn't ashamed to call itself radical. It wasn't ashamed to declare itself in favour of public services and the public sector and a decent revenue base. All of that can apply. And they're the sort of questions that should be resolved by the party itself, not have decisions imposed, because the structure is so monstrously undemocratic that the party itself has no real say in it. The question from here was,
why is Labor so unpopular?
Yeah,
in view of the economic conditions.
Yeah. I'm not one who ever blames a problem on, the only problem we have is not the substance, but we can't communicate. Because my view is, to say you can't communicate is like a sprinter who can't run fast. If you can't communicate, you shouldn't be in public office.
Yeah.
Remember this, as I mix with these people, I worked in the same buildings, they're among the people I know well. The Governor Macquarie Tower, and there's people who worked in it here, knowing full well that a coalition government was going to be very bad for them, knew the former government was so bad, they voted Liberal or something other than Labor and gave their preferences against Labor because they knew in the interest of the people of New South Wales and the government of the state, we had to go. So all of the background detail about unemployment figures and all the rest, that's a tableau. What you have highlighted is the absolute totality of our failure, because the objective circumstance in the hands of a Whitlam or a Menzies would mean landslide victories.
Final comment, Jim.
Look, I agree with that completely. Let me say this. The reason why our workers are not supporting Labor, despite every logical reason for doing so, is that the heart of Labor no longer beats. The heart of Labor doesn't beat anymore. There's no rapport anymore. I came off the waterfront. I worked on the waterfront in the 50s. And I tell you what, we had some terrific fights, physical and otherwise, down there. The Communist Party versus the Labor Party. But when there was an injured worker, when a worker died, when a widow of a worker was in trouble, that workforce united around the injured person, around the widow. No, no, we paid for their funerals. We were one solid group of people, totally based on each other in a fraternal comradeship, which is missing today because the heart of Labor no longer beats.
Well, it's been a fascinating night. I'm grateful to all our three speakers. Jim is a former member of the anti-communist industrial groups. Cassandra outed herself as a former member of resistance, who came down from the trees to join everyone else on the ground. And Rodney, well, Rodney's Rodney. And
irrevocably mainstream Labour.
Irrevocably mainstream Labour. So we all meet together at the Sydney Institute in what's a very fine debate about the Labour Party with a number of different viewpoints. expressed. I won't go on except to say thanks to our speakers, and also you saw the Jim Mackin's passion. This book, What Is To Be Done, is very much in the old style Labour movement pamphlet. Those of you who remember the old Labour movement pamphlets, fine, argumentative, polemic. That's what we've heard tonight, that's what's in the book. The copy's up the back, but we've had a great night tonight, an important night, and all our speakers have given us papers, so they'll be published by Anne and the Sydney Papers online reasonably soon. So for tonight, thanks to Jim, to Cassandra, and to Rodney. Thank you all.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.